He didn't follow my go-to statement that even Casey missed. I'll move it up. Here you go.
Go-to fail.
Nice.
Because I didn't want you just running off the end. Like, you go, you got to end up going back to ask ATP, and then I guess you just run off the end again, and it loops. What can you do? It's basic.
Last we spoke, which feels like 13 years ago, or maybe it was just last year, I guess.
It was exactly 7 days ago.
Was it really?
No.
Oh, God. I thought, I'm so out of whack.
You forgot the joke already? It hasn't been that
long.
Yeah,
I know. It, as soon as I said, was it really? I was like, no, wait, he's making the joke again. No, I've been off for 2 weeks, so I haven't had a job, and it's totally screwed up my schedule.
Heather, we're going to talk about that, by the way. I know it's not in the list, but we're going to talk about that.
Oh, God. Okay. Anyway, so exactly 7 days ago is what I said. Apple, well, it was before Apple issued their December 28th memo entitled A Message to Our Customers About iPhone Batteries and Performance. So this is Apple trying to do some PR cleanup about the battery gate, if you will. The last time we spoke, this hadn't been shared yet. A lot of people seemed semi-angry with us that we didn't take Apple to task more about this. A lot of people deeply believe that the only reasonable explanation for this battery stuff isn't science, it isn't chemistry, it's greed. The only logical explanation for this is that Apple's greedy and wants us to buy new phones. So anyway, so Apple's been doing a lot of cleanup. I'm satisfied with this, but I was obviously the least punchy about this issue in the first place. So I don't know. John, you haven't had much to say. Let's start with you. How do you feel about this PR push? And does this make you feel better, worse, different? Don't care. Tell me.
I thought the PR message was good. Apple's usually pretty good with PR. Like, you can read it and it uses like regular English sentences and says and explains things in a straightforward way without tons of weasel words in it. I mean, it's not going to convince anybody who's still convinced that Apple is, you know, doing evil things on purpose, whatever. But, you know, it's straightforward, and I think it's worth linking to for people who haven't read it, because, like, very often companies will put out a press release and you'll kind of have to read your, you know, the, you know, whatever, the tech side of your choice to get an explanation of what the press release says, you know? Right. But in the case of Apple's things, I think you can just read the press release. Like, you don't need someone to interpret and to translate from corporate ease into regular language. And again, it doesn't mean you're going to find it convincing or like, oh, now I'm convinced. Before, I didn't believe it, but Apple told me they're not doing anything wrong, and now I believe them. Whatever. Like, but anyway, you can read it and hear an explanation. And it is typically vague because they don't want to go into super techie details. And I still have some curiosity about the super techie details, mostly because I want to have something else I can tell people who have questions about it. I know this is just about the press release, and we'll get to the little thing that Rene Ritchie tweeted about it in a second. But the question I have, and maybe you guys know the answer, maybe you read something more about it, is because a lot of people are wondering, hey, is this happening to my iPhone? Right. So there's lots of people who say, oh, you can run this thing, it'll check your battery health, and if it's below a certain percentage, then it's probably doing it, and blah, blah, blah. But the other way people have to test it is, you know, I'll run a benchmark, and, you know, my wife has a brand new version of the same phone as me, and she runs a benchmark, and gets this number, and now I run it on my phone with an old battery, and I get that number. Or I run the benchmark, and then I get my battery replaced, and I run the benchmark again. Like, the idea that running benchmarks and getting some numbers is a way to sort of gauge whether you're subject to the throttling. And the question I have about this, and I don't know the answer to it, but like, I think might be sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy, is if Apple's throttling thing is there to, as Apple says, and as most people seem to agree, like, mechanically speaking, like, how does it actually work? Like, that it clocks things down to prevent sort of the maximum power draw. Like, these things, if they run at their maximum speed and they draw the most power that they can draw, sometimes it's just too much and the old batteries can't keep up. And so what they're trying to do by downclocking is to prevent you from ever drawing that much, right? But during normal use, like, my question is it down clock all the time? Like, from boot time on, it's like, we would run your thing at, you know, 1 gigahertz, but now we're running it at 800 megahertz. So I'm just making up numbers. These aren't real. And we just run it that way from the boot time on, and we never change the clock speed. It's 800 instead of 1 gigahertz the whole time. Or does it down clock in response to demand? In other words, it's running at full speed until you go and try to run something extremely intensive like a benchmark, and then it downclocks you, because if it didn't downclock you, would see that you're about to draw too much power. I don't know the answer to that, but I think if that is the case, if it's dynamically downclocking, then by running a benchmark, you are forcing your phone into the downclock mode. And for all you know, when you're sitting there reading Twitter or sending text messages, it is actually running at full speed all the time, and it only gets downclocked when you do something demanding. So again, I don't know the answer, and that's a place where I wish Apple would be more forthcoming with the technical details. But, you know, obviously that's not going to be in a press release. And so far, I haven't seen any official word from Apple explaining in nitty-gritty detail exactly what it does to your clock speed.
I don't want to get too far into the weeds on this. I did want to mention there was a great discussion about lots of different sides of this issue, not just how Apple has done the PR and everything, but a lot of very good questions being brought up on last week's episode of The Talk Show with John Gruber and Jason Snell. It's The Talk Show episode number 210 for the show notes. And it was a really good conversation, because there's a lot of sides to this that either we didn't cover or we only briefly covered, and a lot of questions that have come up kind of since then with more time to think about it from exactly 7 days ago. And I think one of the biggest things is, like, there were so many factors that made this a problem that are totally Apple's fault. Like, you know, things like the OSs really do run too slowly on old hardware, and it really does seem like they don't care that much. You know, like, I'm sure it's somebody's job, and maybe a lot of somebody's jobs, to make the OSs work on the older hardware, but the actions speak louder than words, and it clearly is not as high of a priority as it should be. And that's been true for years. So that, you know, that's one of the many problems that really exacerbated this for Apple. You know, the reason why people have been thinking for years that Apple secretly slows down their phones to make them buy new ones is because new OSs so often run so much slower than old ones when you install them on like a one or two generation old phone. So that's a big question. I would also, you know, one of the bigger questions that I think people have been asking over the last couple of weeks is, why did this only happen from the iPhone 6 forward? And is it happening faster than it should? We've heard all sorts of crazy reports, you know, all over Twitter and email and everything. But a lot of people are saying that they're seeing this battery throttling happening on a phone within its first year or its second year. And I don't think that's reasonable. And somebody, I honestly haven't had a lot of time to do research on this. Somebody said Samsung makes some kind of guarantee about a certain battery health percentage after 2 years. I don't know enough about that, but it certainly seems like, yes, batteries do degrade over time, and yes, they have problems, and this is actually a pretty clever engineering solution to try to make phones with, you know, severely degraded batteries still usable. But I would like to hear maybe from people who know more about this stuff, who know more about, like, you know, battery hardware design. Is this actually inevitable at the scale and timeline that it's happening, or is there possibly some kind of bigger design problem here?
So just to get to what Renee communicated, like, Apple in this press release had said that they were going to start this, like, $30 battery replacement thing in mid-January, but actually they're starting it now. Like, they're, you know, their supplies may be limited, but they're not waiting. So if you want to go to an Apple store right now because you think you have a bad battery and you want to get the $30 deal, you can do that. Like, you don't have to wait. So that was the minor announcement. As to what you were getting at, Marco, I think a lot of it is explained by some of things we've experienced, or you've experienced multiple times, with, like, the new laptops. It's a combination.
Not
of,
anymore. My laptop's awesome now.
Yeah, I know. It's a combination of processors getting more powerful and having and being more power efficient by, you know, turning off or downclocking or momentarily increasing and decreasing their clock speed. Like, basically, a larger delta between how much power does the CPU draw when it's not really doing anything, and how much does it draw when it's doing all the things. That gap has gotten wider, and at the same time, Apple has been aggressively making their things thinner and their batteries smaller. And maybe around the iPhone 6 is when it started to cross that threshold of, hey, this system on a chip has a really big range between I'm doing all the things, playing a game, and I'm just, you know, scrolling a text message screen, right? And that at the same time, the battery was getting bigger to power the bigger screens, but also there was still like, there was sort of the end of the thinness race. They don't think they really got much thinner after the 6 model. 6 and 7 and 8 are kind of the same, and actually the 10 is even a little bit thicker than those. Those phones could sort of be the phone equivalent of the 2016-2017 MacBook Pros, where the battery can last a long time if you're scrolling web pages in Safari or using TextEdit or something. But if you're doing anything aggressive on them, your battery life goes in the toilet because the battery is scaled to sort of a low average usage. But if you use all the CPU and GPU all the time, it destroys the battery. And that's obviously it's not shutting off your computer or whatever, but we discussed before the throttling, presumably for thermal reasons on the MacBook Pros. But I think as to whether this is inevitable, I think it's a natural consequence of essentially chips getting better about power efficiency, because they have all these things that if they use all of them at once, it's tremendously fast and uses a lot of power. But it's relying on the fact that most of the time you're not doing that. And so they can get away with putting a very small battery in there. If they had to treat the system on a chips in the iPhone 6, 7, 8, and 10 as if they're running at full blast all the time, the batteries would be three times as big, right? They wouldn't be able to get away with a battery that small in there. And the other possible thing is heat. I don't know what kind of factor that is. I don't feel like the phones get particularly hot, but that could just be because the heat is being trapped on the inside. But any kind of excessive heat, or I suppose cold, really hoses your battery. And I don't know if this is founded in battery chemistry. Some battery expert can tell me or not, but I always get the feeling that like the margin of error on a really small battery is just so much lower. Like that it's thinner, that the temperature gradients can get to like the middle of it, you know what I mean? Like faster. That it's just so wafer thin that if it's hosed in any way, if it's stressed or hosed in any way, there's so little battery there. Like if it's made hot or cold, the whole thing heats through or gets cold straight through immediately because it's like wafer thin, right? As opposed to if it was like a battery like in an old PowerBook that was just huge brick. Subjecting that to external heat for a short period of time, it's like, well, the outside might get hot from whatever warm thing it's next to, but it's going to take a while for that heat to penetrate all the way through the entire cell if the heat is an external source. So I don't know. The solution to all these things is, make processors that take even less energy even when they're going full blast, and put in bigger batteries, because bigger batteries, it's the cure-all to all battery-related things. Yeah, everything gets heavier, and it takes longer to charge. But if you're having problems delivering enough power, or your battery's getting damaged in some way or whatever, if you just have tons of headroom and lots of excess battery capacity, then even if the thing degrades by 20% in the first year, if you are over-provisioned on battery by 50%, you're still good.
Yeah, I think to hopefully put a period on this whole topic, I think the thing that's most unfortunate and distressing about this is that a lot of it, if not all of it, could have been avoided with better messaging from Apple. And if Apple had just been more upfront about, hey, the unfortunate reality is your phone's battery is a little older than, it's designed to be, or not, it's not up to the snuff that we hoped it was. So the bad news is it's not going to run quite at full speed like the CPU won't run quite at full speed as we want it to. But the good news is it won't randomly shut down on you. And, if you have the time, why don't you go to the Apple store and we'll charge you a little bit of money to replace the battery. And had it been messaged more appropriately, I think it would have been a much smaller story, and I think that we can all agree that. But
one more thing about what you were just talking about with the messaging, aside from people like just not believing the messaging and everything, which we went over last show, it's kind of the other problem with that that makes it tricky, and maybe one of the things that motivated Apple not to do it. It's not as if there is like a little thermometer gauge or single number that pops out of the battery that tells you how good or bad your battery is. It's a lot of guesswork and sort of like, well, the last time we went through a charge cycle, here's what the curve looked like and here's what the voltages were at various times. Like, it's a lot of guessing. And it's like, well, but it was in a really cold car then, so does that counter? But now it's really warm. And like, there are just so many variables. And because batteries, Like, they're not like bananas where you get a good one and a bad one, or it's an overripe one or whatever, but they are not as, they're not quite as uniform as other components might be, because it's all just a big chemical soup, and they try to make them all uniform and try to make them all good, but it really depends on how you use your phone. You leave your phone on the dashboard in the sun, or in your car and when it's freezing cold weather because you leave it in your car and you forget it for 2 hours, like, those things hurt your battery. So if they were to bring up that message, the first problem is you could be bringing up a message that's that based on all our heuristics, we kind of think your battery is a little bit crappy. And maybe they're wrong because their heuristics are a little bit off because of extenuating circumstances that weren't taken into account. And now someone is really mad because their phone is 3 months old. And now you get a story. My three-month-old iPhone told me that my battery's bad. Refund, refund, right? And the other possibility is that you are an unlucky person who happened to get a battery that either was bad from the factory or got damaged by some excessive temperature changes during shipping or something like that. Like someone, if all the components that you could potentially get that are end up being like, you know, bad, right? Most of the other components have good, easy ways to test them, but batteries, you can test it at the factory and it'll be like, passes all tests with flying colors, but after 3 weeks of charge cycle, some internal weakness or flaw in the battery causes it to not be performing well. And in that case, I mean, in that case, the messaging is good for the consumer to say like, oh, I've got a bad battery, and presumably they'd get it replaced under warranty. But it's like, how do you distinguish that from the case I described before, where actually your battery is fine and the thing is just freaking out for no good reason? So I'm not sure what the solution is. A lot of time people have battery issues with their phone, and the easy answer is to just get a new battery. And one of the things I think I learned from the feedback from last show is that a surprising number of people who listen to the show either themselves or didn't know or know people who don't know that you can replace the battery on an iPhone. Like that's even a thing that can be done for any amount of money anywhere. I assumed that it was a thing that everybody knew, and I was definitely wrong about that.
Yeah,
Until this thing, I didn't even know you could replace a battery in the phone. If I had known I could have just replaced the battery, I never would have got on a new phone. Now, some people are saying if I had known a battery replacement would fix the problem, but other people were saying I didn't even know that was a thing that you would do, or maybe they didn't think it was a thing that Apple would do. Like maybe you could find some, sketchy vendor who will crack open your phone and give it a go, or you could try to do it yourself, but that it's an official Apple thing that you can do. And the final thing on that is lots of people have been reporting. And I don't know if this is Apple policy or informal Apple policy or not, but before this all happened, if you took a phone to an Apple store and said, hey, I'm having problems with my battery, they would run your phone through like a diagnostic to check like your battery health according to whatever, you know, whatever rules and number pops out, says your battery is like 80% okay or whatever. And there was some number, and if it was below that number, they would say, okay, we'll replace your battery for $80 or whatever, like whatever they were charging, right? But if it was not below that number, if it says your battery is 99% healthy, according to our tests, that they wouldn't do the replacement for you and that you would throw your money at this. No, look here, money, $80, take this money and replace my battery. And they say, no, sorry, our diagnostics tell us that your battery is still good, so we won't replace your thing, right? And enough people gave me that story that it seems like a thing that's really happening. And the reason I was interested in it is because we had an iPhone 5S that it was going to be a hand-me-down phone for my son. And we thought like, oh, before I, you know, it had been well used. It had been used for at least 2 years, maybe longer, heavily used. And so we're like, oh, well, I don't want to give him a phone with a 2-year-old battery. You know, we want to be able to reach him, and he's probably not going to be very good about charging it. So before I give him this phone, let me go to the Apple store and replace the battery. So I brought the 5S to the Apple store to replace the battery. I gave it to the Apple person. I said, here, I made a Genius Bar appointment. And I said, I just want a new battery in this phone. And he takes it from me and runs it through a diagnostic and says, oh, this battery actually looks like it's pretty good. It's like 85%. I'm like, yeah, I know. There's nothing wrong with the battery. I just want to replace it because I'm giving it to my son as a gift and I want him to have a fresh battery. And the guy said, oh, okay. And he did it for me. Right. And only now in retrospect, do I think back to the strange pause and the way he kind of said, oh, to think maybe he was doing me a favor. Like, I wasn't like aggressive about it. I had no expectation that I was going to be told no. I was just explaining, oh yeah, no, sorry to make you think I had a problem with my battery. I don't have a problem with my battery. I am just here saying just period, I want a new battery. Didn't argue with me and didn't tell me they have a policy to do it, but he did do a little pause. So I don't know I don't know what to think anymore. Maybe Apple geniuses can chime in and say what was the policy before this whole throttling PR thing. But either way, at $80, I feel like Apple should have replaced the battery for anybody who could throw that money at them. At $30, I feel like Apple's probably losing money in every one of these battery replacements. So I kind of understand if they're not going to give you the $30 deal if your battery is like brand spanking new and their test says you have, you know, 95% capacity or whatever.
All right. So tell me about phone throttling and how it's not always the explanation.
This is another big thread of feedback. Hey, my phone takes 25 seconds to launch the messages application. Damn, Apple and that thermal throttling. A lot of things can be wrong with phones. I want to tell people that if your phone is super slow and doing all sorts of terrible things, possibly related to this start after the iOS 11 update or whatever it may be, there are many, many things that people have experienced and have written to us about and that I've experienced personally where your phone gets unreasonably slow when it's doing nothing hard and with a brand new battery. And I can tell you that those things are not related to phone throttling. Those are related to something else terrible, and I wish I could tell you what it was. Lots of people like wipe and restore your phone and that would fix it, which is the worst possible. Like, you almost wish that doesn't work. Like, please don't let this work, because it's the worst kind of sort of cross my fingers, plug in and unplug it thing. But very often that actually does work, which is terrible. That should not work. You would love to know what the problem is, but all I'm going to say is if your phone is like really slow, like someone just wrote and said they press play on like a podcast player and it takes 5 seconds for audio to start. That is, I'm pretty sure that's not CPU throttling, right? Because the throttling is not where you slow your CPU to 1%, right? And so if you're getting any kind of performance problems that are pervasive everywhere throughout the operating system and really, really slow, like 100 times, 200 times slower than it should be, like you're waiting 3 minutes for messages to launch, that is not this issue. That is another issue that is probably worse, and we can't even tell you what it is. And if you want to go get a new battery anyway, go ahead. But for those things, it's sometimes it's not a tumor, and sometimes it's not phone throttling. Sometimes it's something even worse. And yes, sometimes it does coincide with an OS upgrade, and I have no explanation for what it is, but I can tell you it is definitely a thing. I experienced it myself. My wife experienced it on her phone. Wiping and restore fixes it for me about like 60% of the time, and I hate that it does. And I don't really recommend people wipe and restore as a matter of course, but unless someone else knows a better way to figure out what the heck that problem is, you just want to make the problem go away sometimes. Unfortunately, sometimes wipe and restore doesn't fix it, and then what do you do? I don't even know. But anyway, all that is to say, if there's something wrong with your phone and it's still under warranty, bring it to the Apple Genius. Let them sort it out. If they can't figure out it, maybe they'll just give you a new phone. But it's not always throttling.
I find in my experience it's usually lupus. Speaking more of throttling, let's talk about the iMac Pro and its thermal throttling. This is the show about throttling, apparently.
Yeah, this is slightly different. But anyway, people have iMac Pros now, including Marco, which we'll get to later in the show. And some of the people who have them are testing them out. And one of the interesting tests that you can do with these, now that they have them and they have something that can measure all the temperatures of all the little bits, is, hey, let's see if anything we can do with this iMac Pro causes any of the parts inside it to not run at their normal clock speed. And the answer is that yes, there are things you can do to make both the CPU and the GPU dip below their normal clock speed, albeit briefly. This is an Apple Insider article, and they ran it through a bunch of benchmarks on CPU and GPU. And for the most part, it stays pegged at whatever its speed, that its rated speed is. But there's nice little graphs where you can see it dips for a second or two down to a slower clock speed, and then goes back up to the top. And the interesting part, I think, about this throttling, and this has nothing to do with battery, obviously, because this guy's plugged in. This is all about heat. The interesting part of this throttling is, I say, during all these tests, the fans are not really going nuts, right? In other words, that it seems like this throttling could be avoided if the system was tuned to crank the fan speed up a little bit more, right? So it seems like, at least as far as this current iteration of whatever firmware and OS combination determines all this stuff, that the iMac Pro is tuned to be quiet as quiet as possible while more or less maintaining maximum speed. And again, you can't instantaneously crank up the fans and instantaneously extract heat that's going to cause the thing to throttle itself, right? So I think their option would be to avoid these brief, you know, 1 or 2 second dips below normal clock speed, right? To avoid that, you would actually have to run the fans louder and sooner, perhaps to a significant degree. And instead, they've chosen to tune this thing to be as quiet as possible while allowing for occasional dips in clock speed, which is an interesting trade-off, which means that I bet this machine is pretty quiet. And again, Marco, you will get a chance to explain all your experiences with this eventually. But also, that this is another way that I feel like this thing is hopefully, probably, potentially differentiated from the Mac Pro. Because, again, if a machine is ever going to be tuned to never dip its clock speed because it can't get enough heat away from it, a purpose-designed modular, doesn't have a screen attached to it, yada, 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 like Pro computer, would be the one to do it. And the all-in-one, sleek, slim, amazingly compact Pro components jammed behind a screen is the one that is going to stay as quiet as possible, but occasionally allow dips in clock speed so it doesn't have to be too noisy.
We are sponsored this week by FlightLogger. Go to flightlogger.co or search for FlightLogger in the App Store. FlightLogger lets you easily search and save your flights, organize them into custom trips, share your travel schedule with friends and family, and much more, all from a very easy-to-use app and, in my opinion, a really nice-looking one. FlightLogger brings the ease back to air travel with a visual timeline of your itinerary to keep you on schedule no matter where you are in the world. You can use FlightLogger to keep track of all your travel information. Any updates or changes, it will alert you. You will never miss a flight again with their real-time notifications on terminal and gate changes. You can track and get notified of arrival and departure times, delays, and baggage claim information, which is awesome. It'll tell you what claim your bags are coming on. And you can share your flight information with friends and family for no waiting airport pickups and peace of mind. Flight logging and flight tracking and flight status apps, honestly, the ones I've seen that aren't FlightLogger, they're kind of a dumpster fire. Like, it is not an easy-to-use, attractive category of apps, generally speaking. And I actually used FlightLogger before they were a sponsor here because I've heard them recommended strongly on other podcasts. And I got to tell you, the hype is real. It's a great app, and it's miles ahead of the others in terms of having a nice appearance and making the features easy to use and easy to understand. It really is great, and it supports all. I mean, there's so much stuff I can't even tell you it all in an ad. You can locate the aircraft on a map. You can see your flight as you go, which I love. You can import flights via email forwarding. You can like just forward your confirmation to a special email address, and it'll import automatically. There's so much to see here, and they even have a cool little trick. Go into the settings menu and shake your phone, and you will get a new entry that I think ATP listeners, especially John Siracusa, might appreciate. So check it out. Go to flightlogger.co. That's FlightLogger in the App Store or flightlogger.co for an incredibly nice, easy-to-use app for easily tracking, saving, and getting alerts for your flights. Once again, thank you so much to FlightLogger, a really cool flight tracking app, for sponsoring our show.
You did order an iMac Pro, as it turns out.
As it turns out, yes, I did.
And?
And I am now running High Sierra.
Aw, welcome to months ago.
Yeah, my fonts are now overly smoothed and blurry because my font smoothing setting is not fixed.
Let me interrupt you right there. I have heard you, you know, kvetching about this for months. I don't understand what it is that you're so angry about, but I really kind of don't want to know because I don't see it right now. I don't see the arrow in the FedEx logo, and I don't want to. So
you haven't changed your settings. Marco is changing his settings from the defaults for font smoothing.
I mean, I used to expect that if a setting is going to be there, that it should work properly. Otherwise, why have the setting?
Wait, so what do you set it to?
So the setting I'm talking about is in settings general, turning off. Use LCD font smoothing when available.
Yeah, mine is off. So what am I supposed to see that's garbage?
It's off?
Yeah.
Okay, open Xcode or something else that would truncate text automatically with an ellipsis. Look in the source list, make it nice and narrow.
All right, hold on. Slow down, man, slow down. I was trying to find the right project, okay.
Launching Xcode, bounce, bounce, bounce.
Launching Xcode on your non-pro iMac must take ages.
Oh, you're such a jerk. Okay, anyway. So I see an ellipsis in the middle of one of the folder names in this particular project.
So what you should see, if that setting is unchecked, mm-hmm. is you should see that the text with an ellipsis should be rendered thicker than the text without the ellipsis.
Oh, f*** you, Marco. Oh, God bless America. Now you see I'm it, right? I'm never going to be able to unsee this now.
Right. And that isn't the only place that this shows up. But basically, like, if text is being rendered with certain... I don't know the details, but with certain like core text behaviors that are being applied to it, they basically make it ignore that setting and make it always use LCD font smoothing. And that's new to High Sierra. That is not yet fixed. In whatever apps and workflows and things I use, that shows up a lot. So I'd rather just live with my blurry text everywhere than have it be inconsistently blurry. So right now I am living with that setting back on, which is the default. And it sucks, but it sucks less than having everything be inconsistent. I think it also applies to Finder windows and stuff. Like it applies a lot of places, and it's annoying.
So why do you think LCD font smoothing is blurrier than plain old anti-aliasing? To my eyes, plain old anti-aliasing with gray pixels is blurrier than the little subpixel thing that the LCD thing is doing.
I haven't ever like taken a macro lens to my screen and really like compared how they're doing it, but it seems like the effective visual thickness of the fonts, like how thick they appear to be, appears slightly thicker when it's using the LCD font smoothing, which is their version of subpixel anti-aliasing.
I would think it was the opposite. In old non-retina monitors, like the one I'm staring at, I always find the opposite, that LCD font smoothing makes them appear thinner, and plain old anti-aliasing with a series of grayish pixels makes them look thicker.
Yeah, and that's what I would assume, but like regardless, the way it appears visually to me, like perceiving the perception of how it looks, is that when the subpixel anti-aliasing is being used, which is the default, the fonts do appear thicker.
Yeah, I would agree with that when I ticked this checkbox back on, everything appeared thicker to me than otherwise. I don't know. Weird, though. Well, thank you for ruining that.
Yeah, you're welcome. You can go back to Sierra. It won't happen anymore.
All right. So how's your iMac Pro? It's beautiful. I've seen one once at WWDC. In fact, John was with me. I can tell you they're beautiful, but tell me, other than the physical appearance, how is it?
Honestly, ask me next week, because I've had it for literally one day, a day during which I have been able to do very little on it because I've been very, very busy. The one thing I'm using it right now. It's wonderful so far. It does look incredible. All the black things on my desk now look cool. The few remaining silver things on my desk, like my speaker and headphone amps, now look really out of place because they're silver instead of black. So God knows what I'm going to do about that. And
but, yeah, what about all your shit boxes? Those all are exactly silver, right?
They are, yeah. Now, it does have black versions of some of their products, so I might look into that, but...
oh, God.
I could just move them or just deal with it.
I can get you a can of Krylon. You can fix all those silver boxes real quick.
Yeah. Anyway, my initial impressions, I don't really have any yet because it hasn't been enough time. However, one thing that is immediately striking, besides the look, is just how incredibly quiet it is. Even quieter than the 5K, it for me at least. And maybe that's because my 5K is old and the platters are full of bad blocks or whatever the Apple people told me. I don't know. But
more likely the inside of the case is filled with dog hair.
My dog doesn't shed.
You're right. It doesn't shed.
That makes a difference. And he really doesn't. He needs a haircut very badly, but he does not shed. Anyway, so it's strikingly quiet. Like, it is ridiculously quiet. So I am very much enjoying that. And... that, if nothing else, will push me to very aggressively move this into being Tiff's computer as soon as the Mac Pro is presumably released, if I want it, because I want her computer across the room to be this quiet as well. It is shocking how quiet it is, and how quiet it seems to remain under load by all the reviews. But I have not experienced that yet. But ask me again next week.
So both Jason Snell and Underscore have told me that FFmpeg encodes tend to be twice as quick on the iMac Pro as compared to my 5K iMac. And although I don't do FFmpeg encodes as often as I probably paint it, it happens often enough that I am salivating at the thought of it. And then I see the price tag and I'm reminded that I don't need one of these after all. My goodness. It seems like it's just so much faster and I'm super jealous.
I just think all my RAM errors are being corrected and detected. Oh man, this is so great.
That's so harsh.
It's so nice to be back on a Mac Pro again.
Oh, you are so mean to John.
Yeah, like I said in the follow-up, but I do find it interesting that this machine appears to be tuned for quiet above all else, which is like an interesting way to go for, you know, like, but what it says to me that they do actually have more cooling, especially since they chose parts that are clocked lower, like whatever these special number parts that they use from Intel that are like similar to other parts that Intel offers, but a little bit lower clocked. Like they would have the headroom, but they wanted it to be quieter, right? Rather than having it like, it's almost as if the design goal was quieter than the 5K iMac, which you could see them maybe saying it should be as quiet as the 5K iMac, but it ends up being quieter, like, you know, dramatically quieter. And not because it can be that quiet and never throttle, but it can be that quiet and almost never throttle. Like just little blips here and there. Like I encourage people to check out the Apple Insider article and look at the graphs. It's mostly never throttling, little dips here and there. And so, and again, this probably varies on the ambient temperature of the room, how good the thermal paste is on the model that you happen to get, all sorts of things like that. That's something else that a couple of follow-up YouTube links that unfortunately I don't have for the show notes, but if you just go onto YouTube and look for like iMac or Apple thermal throttle cooling, blah, 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 MacBook thermal throttling. One of the things that the PC builders like to do is take apart Apple computers and take off the heat sinks and the heat pipes and scrape off the thermal paste and put on like their fancy thermal paste. Sometimes they put on multiple kinds of fancy thermal paste, which boggles my mind that they take the entire thing apart, scrape off the thing, clean the CPU and the heat sink, put on thermal paste, reassemble the entire thing, test it, and then repeat it, only to scrape off the paste they just put on and put on even more ridiculously expensive special thermal paste made with, like, you know,
Arctic silver.
Yeah, exactly. Like made with these adamantium elements that make the things like more expensive than printer ink. But they get like, you know, double, you know, single or even sometimes double digit increases in or decreases in temperature just from merely applying new thermal paste or better thermal paste. And this is true not just of laptops, but of all computers. As it ages and as that you go through heat and cool cycles over and over again, the thermal bond between whatever is pulling heat away from your chip and the top of the chip itself degrades, right? And I've always wondered why Apple doesn't use whatever these very fancy thermal paste things are. Maybe these ones last even like they're good when they're installed new, but after a year they're crap. Maybe it's just a cost saving thing. Maybe they can't get thermal paste of that quality in the volumes needed to sell millions and millions of whatevers. But it's always something I suspect when I hear someone says like, oh, I got a 5K iMac and it's like super loud. Or, you know, that happened with the PlayStation 4. So a lot of the PlayStation 4 is like, I got a brand new PlayStation 4 and it sounds like a jet engine is taking off. And again, getting back to the battery as being like the sort of touchy-feely, squishy element you get a bad banana, right? The touchy-feely, squishy element of almost all electronics these days is how well assembled and was it? Like, how good is the thermal bond between the hot little square or rectangle and the apparatus meant to pull heat away? And so you may end up getting a PlayStation 4 where it's just not seated properly, or there's not enough thermal paste, or there's too much thermal paste, or it's crooked, or some other problem with it. And right out of the box, the fans run at max speed. You're like, oh, what's wrong with this thing? It's like, yeah, that part of it. Like the silicon chip is solid state, and they can test it and verify it. And if it's good, it's probably good. But, and you know, the assembly process, if they over torque or under torque a few screws, it doesn't matter. But if one of those screws is one of the screws that keeps the heat sink properly seated on the thing, or if like the little machine or person that puts the thermal paste on got it off by a few millimeters, or like just so many things can go wrong that seem like sort of very analog. And if that goes wrong, it's like you just feel like you lost the lottery, like you're bummed out, or you won the crappy lottery. Like most of the time, everything's fine. But every once in a while you get a lemon and you're like, why are these fans so loud? It's like, if you're one of those people, you could crack it open and try to fix it. But if you're not, you have to just try to return it or try to, they'll say, oh, fan noise is normal. When you're playing a game, the fans just spin up. It's like, yeah, but when I just turn it on, like, listen to this, you can tell there's something wrong with it, right? And you have to argue with the person and beg. And it's like my worst nightmare. I've had pretty good luck with with fans so far. But like, imagine you get a new 5K iMac. Who was the one who did this? Was it Stephen Hackett who's complaining about his noisy 5K iMac? Someone we know, I think, recently got a brand new 5K iMac and could not believe how loud it was. And whenever I hear that, I'm like, maybe they just expected it to be quieter, or maybe they lost the thermal paste lottery.
Yeah, well, and that, I think that one was actually like a defective one. But I will say that, like, you know, now having used the 5K iMac full time for 3 years, my only complaint really was that under load, it got loud, and it was kind of annoying, you know, to hear the fans when it was under a load. And so to have this brand new, awesome, high-end generation of the iMac basically not do that at all, or do that to such a small level that most people don't even notice it's doing it at all, basically to have it be quiet under most loads, that is a huge upgrade. And you know, and you could argue, as some people like on that Apple Insider, you know, comment thread did, you can argue like it's a pro machine, it should never throttle from thermals. But I think there's a question of degree there. If it can be really, really quiet under most workloads and only give up like 1% of its total throughput on the CPU, I would probably take that trade-off, and I bet most buyers would too.
Yeah, especially since you would have to run the fan, not just like, oh, like during those blips, just make the fan a little faster. I think to get rid of those blips, you would have to substantially run the fan substantially faster much earlier than you think you would have to. It's not as if you can react to them in real time with fan speed. And so it is actually a trade-off. And so basically, like, these things look like they're pretty much never throttling in exchange for very quiet performance, and you could go to absolutely never throttling in exchange for iMac 5K performance, you know?
Right, but like, I don't want that. Like, I gladly would give up that last little tiny percentage of performance for a computer that is quiet pretty much all the time than one that does what the 5K iMac does, which is just ramp up, ramp down, ramp up, ramp down. Like, you can always hear those things moving.
Mm-hmm. Or we can just wait for the Mac Pro and have it all.
We hope, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right. Until it's introduced, it's the fantasy computer that solves everyone's problems.
Exactly. So Max Uck in the chat asks, is it possible that I would ever stick with the iMac Pro and not buy the Mac Pro? That is possible. I don't, we won't really know until the Mac Pro is released, you know, what it is.
Correction. It is impossible that you won't buy the Mac Pro, but it is possible that you buy it, return it, and then go back to the iMac Pro.
Truth.
It's possible, but, you know, because I am going to probably be incredibly satisfied with the iMac Pro in the meantime. And I, as I mentioned on previous shows, if the iMac Pro was it, If there was not going to be another Mac Pro, if this was the only, you know, Mac Pro Xeon workstation that Apple is going to make, I would totally just buy it and be fine with it. And I would occasionally complain, like, if I had to bring in my computer for service and I lost my whole computer because the monitor had a dead pixel, like, that would make me upset. But, you know, otherwise, I've been using a 5K iMac for the last 3 years because I decided the overall package of the iMac with the wonderful Retina screen and everything was better for me than the 2013 Mac Pro. I might make that same decision again after seeing the Mac Pro, the next Mac Pro. But the next Mac Pro will also be apparently allegedly coming with a new Pro display. I assume it's going to be at least a 5K Retina display, if not bigger. Man, it'd be awesome if it was 8K or something. But you know, I don't know how likely that is this year. But if they release something that ends up being less compelling to me than the iMac Pro, then I'll get an iMac Pro for myself and give this one to Tiff. Maybe I'll wait till the next generation. Probably not, because you know. And I've seen a lot of people, a lot of like, you know, Mac commentators and everything saying, you know, we really have to see how often Apple updates the iMac Pro. They're expecting like annual updates, and don't expect that, because even if Apple is serving this line responsibly and as well as they possibly can, they probably won't update the iMac Pro in a meaningful way annually. They might, and they should, update the GPUs annually. I don't know that they will, but the most responsible way to update this machine would be to update the GPUs basically whenever there's a new, like, major update to the GPU line that it uses, which is usually about once a year. But the Xeon CPUs that it uses are not updated every year. Usually Intel gives meaningful Xeon updates about every 18 months to 2 years. So that's the kind of upgrade cycle that I hope to see here. Anything less than that, I think, is optimistic. And they would only be able to update the GPU, maybe the SSD, but probably not any meaningful CPU updates more often than that.
So far, so good. Not a lot to say because it's brand new.
Yeah. An hour in? Yeah.
Yep. I was going to be quick, remember? Are you keeping your peripherals?
The black ones?
Mm-hmm.
Hell yeah.
But you won't be using the keyboard, I assume. Is that correct?
No, that's true. The keyboard I am not planning on using because I use a natural keyboard, which is all... The keyboard I use is the Microsoft Sculpt ergonomic keyboard, which happens to also be black and gray, so... That works out well. It looks awesome with all the new stuff. So I do have the black trackpad and the black mouse. The black keyboard is still in the box, and I don't know. I'll probably just send it to John or somebody. I don't know. Do you want it?
I'm already buying Snails.
Oh, I was going to give you mine for free.
If you want to send me it for free, I'll also take it.
Yeah. Casey, do you want it?
Well, I am acquiring underscores, coincidentally. Underscore got a...
The what do you call it? The black market, so to speak, for black iMac Pro peripherals is alive and kicking.
The space gray market.
Coincidentally, underscore... This is the thing, like, if I were to order myself an iMac Pro, whether or not I wanted any of the peripherals, there is absolutely no chance I would not order all three of them. I would order the keyboard, which of course you have to get. I would order a mouse, and I would order a trackpad, because why would you not get the whole set? And underscore did that. And even though I am not a trackpad kind of guy, when he told me he had the whole set, I was like, all right, just send me an Apple Pay cash request for whatever the sum total of that would be. I don't even want to know what it is until you ask for it. So I can't back down, because I'm sure it'll be like $300. But, I'll just take the whole set off your hands, and I'm very looking forward to it.
So about, I don't know, a year or two ago, I added a trackpad to my setup. So I have left trackpad, right mouse.
And that's what I plan to do.
Keyboard in the middle. It's really nice. Like, it takes only days to get into the habit of using the trackpad with your left hand. I'm not using it all the time. I'm basically just switching off. Like, if I need to reach something with my left hand, I can. If I need to move with the mouse, use my right hand, I can do that too. Like, it's surprisingly easy to get accustomed to regularly using more than one input device, even with your non-dominant hand. It's really nice. And now, like, I'll occasionally have, like, I'll need the desk space for something else for, like, an hour, and I'll move the trackpad, like, up, you know, to a different spot where it is, so it's not accessible to me. And I miss it immediately. I keep, like, putting my hand where it is, expecting to use it, and it's not there. So it's like it really has worked itself into my setup very, very fully, and it's really nice. And I miss it when it isn't there.
Yeah, I don't know how much I'll use it in general, but in the brief amount of time I've used Final Cut Pro, oh boy, do I wish I had a trackpad for a lot of that. So I am a devout mouse user in general, but for that, I am very looking forward to having the trackpad.
Yeah, so. It's very nice for the two-finger scrolling gestures in both directions.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And so, like, you know, I started it for Logic when editing podcasts, so I could scroll the timeline left and right. That's probably why you want it for Final Cut Pro, right?
Yep.
Now I'm good enough, I'm precise enough with it that I can pretty much use regular mouse functionality at pretty much full speed with my left hand whenever I need to, and it's wonderful.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, I want to use it for scrolling laterally in the timeline and also zooming, you know, so making, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know what the technical terms are for this, but, you know, rather than showing the entire timeline of a maybe 15-minute video all on screen at once, maybe I want to blow it up so that there's only 10 seconds of video being shown on my entire 5K screen. And I'm doing that deliberately because I'm, like, really trying to tweak timing on something. So I'm looking forward to pinch to zoom and all that. So, yeah, I'm going to be freaking broke, but I am looking forward to these stealthy, you know, space gray, don't call it black peripherals.
You guys both need 27-inch iPad Pros so you can do multi-touch editing of your podcasts and video.
True.
Like you're like 1 degree, like you're doing this indirect thing where you're swiping around while staring at a screen. It's like, just bring them together. You're so close.
Yeah.
Use all your fingers and your hands and your elbows.
We are sponsored this week by Casper. Start sleeping ahead of the curve and get $50 towards select mattresses by visiting casper.com/ATP and using code ATP at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. Casper mattresses are wonderful. They are perfectly designed for humans, engineered to soothe and cradle your natural geometry. You spend a third of your life sleeping, so you should be comfortable, and Casper helps you do that by providing all the support the human body needs in all the right places, because it's fairly complex. You can't just have the same, you know, foam layering or the same density at all parts of the mattress, because our bodies have these shapes that need to be supported in different ways, have different weights to them, and Casper has engineered this. They've designed and developed and engineered these mattresses, all in the U.S., by the way, with these wonderful, breathable designs to help you sleep cool and regulate your temperature throughout the night, with multiple supportive memory foams for a quality sleep with just the right sink and just the right bounce. With over 20,000 reviews and an average of 4.8 stars across Casper's online store, Amazon, and Google, it is very quickly becoming the internet's favorite mattress. They now have three mattress models, the original Casper, the Wave, and the Essential, and they also have a wide variety of other products to ensure a great sleep, like sheets and pillows. And all this is available at very affordable prices because they cut out the middleman and sell directly to you. All this is very easy. It kind of sounds crazy to buy mattresses online, but they have wonderful, easy shipping. It comes in a box. You can even get it upstairs if you need to. Then it expands out, and it's wonderful. And they have no hassle returns after 100 nights if you are not completely satisfied. Free shipping and returns in the U.S. and Canada. It couldn't be easier. Start sleeping ahead of the curve with a Casper mattress. Get $50 towards select mattress models by visiting casper.com/ATP and using code ATP at checkout. That's casper.com/ATP with code ATP for $50 towards select mattresses. Terms and conditions apply. Thank you so much to Casper for sponsoring our show.
All right, anything else about the iMac Pro before we move on to this Intel thing?
I don't know if we have, do we have time for the Intel thing? I think we have to get to Ask ATP and we can push the Intel thing off till next week, by which time planes will be falling from the sky.
Oh, come on. We have time for at least the opening of the Intel thing. We'll talk about it for a little bit, and then I think Ask ATP will be quick, famous last words.
Well, the thing is, like, the Intel thing, it's huge news, but we don't really know a lot about it yet. So we need to talk about it. But we're going to be talking about it more next week.
I know enough about it to give a reasonable summary.
All right, so let me take a stab as chief summarizer in chief, and John, whenever you get fed up with it, just interrupt me and we'll move along. It appears that on Intel CPUs for sure, but probably on other CPU architectures, there is an exploit wherein, and I have to back up just a half step. You know, as a CPU is executing instructions, as it's executing code, one of the things that modern CPUs will do is they'll start looking ahead to what code is coming, and they'll start actually pre-executing some of that code in some circumstances to get kind of ahead of the game. This is like when you grab a book and jump to the last page and see, you know, who killed who, or, you know, who survives at the end, or whatever the case may be. So these CPUs will look a little bit ahead and start to execute stuff that they think is coming. And that's true of most modern CPU architectures. But what's a little bit different between CPU architectures is that some of them, or I understand that some of them have some protections around what's considered like operating system or really kernel code and what's considered kind of quote unquote the user's code. And
You're straying.
All right.
Warning.
All right, here we go.
Abort.
All
right. Abort.
Then just cut in now. Cut in now.
All right. Everything you said up to that point is good about speculative execution. And again, I'm not an expert on this either, and it just came out today, and I'm reading about it after work, so forgive me if I'm getting some parts of it wrong. The exploit, as it has been explained to me in various articles and over Twitter, so take that for what it is that during the speculative execution of instructions, it will start executing instructions before it's sure whether they are valid things to do. And depending on what mode your CPU is in and what address it's trying to reference and so on and so forth, there are certain things that you could be trying to do that are invalid, reading from a memory location that you're not allowed to read from because it's not mapped into your process or something like that or whatever. Or reading from kernel memory, which is a distinction that exists in pretty much all modern processors of having memory space that belongs to the kernel that can't be read by usual LAN processes. And it will do the speculative execution and then eventually figure out, you're not supposed to do that. I wasn't supposed to do it. And it'll be like, oh, well, okay, I'm not allowing that to proceed. You're not going to actually be able to do whatever it is you were trying to do, even though I kind of sort of already executed part of it. But never mind, let me undo that. And so it undoes it, right? But given how far ahead of itself it does speculative execution, not just like one or two things ahead, but several things ahead, if the instructions are dependent on each other, so I'm going to speculatively execute this operation here, and then I'm also going to speculatively execute the next one, which depends on the result of the first one, and then it turns out like you weren't allowed to do that one, and so it rolls everything back, right? So it's not like you actually successfully read something you weren't supposed to. But the side effects of doing those operations can leave a bunch of crap in the cache. And you're like, well, so what? The stuff that's in the cache is not the stuff that I wasn't supposed to read because that never got there because I wasn't even supposed to do that read. But because the thing you weren't supposed to read influenced what got put in the cache from the other instruction, you can back solve and figure out what the place you weren't supposed to read from was based on how the result of that was used to get. I know this is very confusing. Like, it's basically like looking at the side effects of an operation that you weren't supposed to do and that was actually rolled back just to figure out what that number must have been, what that in that memory address must have been. And in that way, you can figure out, someone was saying even like just a bit at a time, like you can figure out what the most significant or least significant bit of that address used to be. You can slowly but surely reveal the entire contents of physical memory, much of which belongs to processes that you're never supposed to see. And that is a pretty terrible bug, which basically means all the protections of saying you just can't read arbitrary memory on the system because all sorts of stuff is in memory, like encryption keys and the password that someone just typed and all sorts of stuff is in memory, like in physical memory on your computer. All the protections of the operating system and the CPU and all that stuff are supposed to prevent you from reading, you know, memory from processes that belong to the operating system itself, memory from processes that belong to other users. For example, if you are using AWS, Amazon Web Services, or other shared hosting where your stuff may be running on the same real or virtual CPU as other people's stuff, and you have no visibility to them, you don't see their other processes or whatever, but physically speaking, the machine that you're running on in RAM next to your information is somebody else's information. If you can dump all of RAM by using this exploit to slowly reveal every single address in memory, that's really, really, really bad. And this is not just like, oh, someone, like there's a bug in this processor, like the fdiv bug or something, and they'll just fix it by making a new version of the processor. This is more or less inherent to the way speculative execution works. Like their whole cleanup process actually does the cleanup, but they didn't realize that the thing that was valid to do, if it was influenced by the thing that was invalid to do, can leave information hanging around such that you can back solve and figure out what the invalid information you were supposed to be getting at was. That's my attempt to explain this and why it's not just like, oh, there's a mistake in an Intel CPU and they'll fix it. It's why it affects like all Intel CPUs for the past many, many years, not just like one thing. It's why it also affects ARM CPUs. ARM came out and said, yes, this affects our CPUs as well. AMD says it doesn't affect their CPUs because they do speculative execution in a different way. And it's not like this is unfixable. But you will have to fix it in hardware, you'll have to change the way the hardware works. And like the general trade-off they're making here is the hardware wants to be fast. So it's like, we'll clean up after ourselves and try to be secure. But if we don't have to clean something up, like that information that was pulled into that cache line or whatever, oh, you don't need to clean that up because that was from the valid operation. So that one is fine. Like, it's garbage data, but it's not insecure. It's not like we're leaving information in there that will let someone get something. So just leave it there because it would be more costly to erase that, right? And they're going to have to make different trade-offs to get rid of this because it's not like something they can, you know, first of all, they can't fix it in the CPUs that are already out there because it's out there is out there. And they can fix it in future architectures if they take it into account, but it's going to make a big difference. Now, the fix for it in software that people are slowly rolling out and that actually is in a macOS 10.13.2
Yep.
Has this fix, according to one random person on Twitter. The fix they're doing is basically to say that when you're in a process, don't map the kernel into the same address space as the process. Put it in an entirely different address space, entirely separate address space, so you can't use this exploit, so that you would have to switch modes and go into and switch memory images and go into an entirely different address space, which is slower, and people are doing benchmarks and saying, okay, with this software fix where we shove the kernel into an entirely different place instead of allowing the kernel to virtually live inside the same virtual address space as every user land process, which makes it really easy to, when you switch into kernel mode, to do kernel stuff, then user stuff, right? It makes it slower to do that if you more widely separate them, but it fixes this vulnerability. So everyone now is benchmarking, how much slower is it? Is it 30% slower? Is it 1% slower? Is it only slower when you do heavy I/O? Is it only slower in our synthetic benchmarks, but it's just the same and normal? Does the frame rate of my game go down? So now everyone's, you know, applying patches to their Linux kernels or trying the Windows patch version or whatever and trying to see if, you know, just how bad the performance hit is. But this is a really critical, serious bug, because the only way it's really, truly going to be fixed at the hardware level is for them to make different design decisions, different fundamental design decisions about speculative execution in their CPUs. And they're going to have to figure out a way to do that so it's fast, too. And everyone's freaking out about it, especially for things like shared hosting, because like you can exploit this from anywhere, basically. Like, if you can just get code to run on the CPU and, you know, at a low enough level, then you can just dump the entire contents of memory of that machine, no matter, you know, your processes, other people's processes, the operating system, everything. It's like Heartbleed times 1,000. Like, not just get information about the process that you're exploiting, get information about the, you know, anything else that is running on the hardware, which is slightly terrifying. So understandably, everyone who does shared hosting and everyone has an operating system is all busily trying to update their kernels to work around this thing at the cost of a potential speed hit and then dealing with the fallout of that speed hit. But yeah, so Apple's already got the fix in the latest version of High Sierra. There was some tweet about the upcoming version of High Sierra having something else in regard to this. Some of the chat room just pointed out that, like, there are JavaScript proof of concepts. Like, when I say you can get something to run on the CPU, it doesn't matter what it is. Like, if you can, like, imagine running JavaScript that accidentally dumps the entire contents of your machine's RAM. That's bad. That's pretty bad.
That's like, terrifying. Again,
this is like one of those exploits that, like, you'd see in a movie and like, that's so stupid. You can't run something on a web page that dumps the contents of RAM. There's a little thing called memory protection dummy.
Now wait a minute. I think you might be either you're misunderstanding these or I am, basically. So there are two big bugs or two big exploits that we're talking about here. The names, I think, finally came out tonight. One of them is called Meltdown and one of them is called Spectre. And the Meltdown is the one that basically allows the cache priming effects that you were talking about earlier, like when you try to access an invalid address, you can basically run timing, like run very precise timing benchmarks to figure out like is something cached or not, and then you can figure out based on that like what addresses certain kernel functions map to that have been randomized using address space layout randomization, and so that's how you can like but you can't read other processes' memory space. You can only read the kernel memory because the kernel memory has been shadow mapped into your process space. And by the way, I am so sorry to anybody listening who this is over your head. We can try to explain it, but it would take a long time because we'd have to explain virtual memory and addresses of functions and interrupts and everything, and it would be kind of a problem. So I'm so sorry. Feel free to skip the rest of the chapter if you want. but anyway... So that's the Meltdown attack. And then the Spectre attack is not about revealing kernel addresses of things. It is about actually dumping kernel memory and being able to access the contents of kernel memory. But it's only kernel memory, not because it is mapped into your process, not the memory of other processes on the system.
I'm pretty sure from the explanation that I read, I'm pretty sure that either a combination of these exploits or one or the other can actually eventually iteratively go through the entire address space and eventually get all the contents of RAM presumably by walking your whole giant, you know, address space and causing it to page in to physical space every one of the things that you read, pushing out everything else in turn in RAM. It may just be kernel space. Even if it's just kernel space, that's still pretty bad because tons of interesting information is in there. But it seemed to me that the reason people are scared about shared hosting is that, and that how you could jump read processes in a different virtual machine is one of the other proof of concepts in like the Google paper.
That's bad,
right?
Yeah,
that's not just looking at the kernel space that's in your process, but that you're able to look into the memory inside other virtual machines. Makes me think that you can actually get just dumps of the contents of RAM. But these are, you know, so we'll put a bunch of links in the show notes, all of which I have not had a chance to read because, again, this is all coming out just, you know, today, now as I'm leaving work, these things are coming out. There are abstracts, there are white papers, there's proof of concepts on these things. There's a nice Google site. Google has one of the projects that it called Google Project Zero found either one or both of these exploits originally. Google also has a good page that explains in sort of much simpler language than we're doing here, a very broad, vague kind of thing about speculative execution exists. It's supposed to clean up, but some stuff gets left around. Like that's all you really need to know to understand the nature of this thing. We're trying to get down to the nitty-gritty details, but Google also lists, okay, here's all the things Google has. We have all of our different services and Gmail and Google Cloud things. And, you know, like, and they go through them all one by one and say, here's how this is with respect to this bug. We've patched these. We haven't patched these. This will be patched soon, which is nice. I was looking for a similar page from Apple, but I suppose such a thing is not forthcoming. Or maybe they're just, you know, come out with it tomorrow or whatever. But every person out there, I'm assuming Amazon is doing something similar, has to now explain to you how many of their systems are vulnerable, how many have had their kernel patched to fix this, and what the timelines are, and you know what you can expect as the customer. Like if you have an Android phone, is that vulnerable? Like how old is your Android phone? Who makes it? So on and so forth. Because this type of vulnerability is really scary. Like basically, if you cause untrusted code to run on your CPU, and again, trying to do it from JavaScript, just shows you like code. I wouldn't run untrusted code. Oh, do you load web pages? Because you're running essentially untrusted code then. You know, bad things can happen. Now, as for the performance issues, when I first thought this was a performance bug, I wasn't that worried about it because I was like, well, no matter how big the performance problem is, if you're not worried about being exploited, you know what I mean? Like, I can imagine like having a toggle switch that says, switch into this mode and I'm just going to run a local game that I trust, right? And I'll get full performance from my game. But the more I hear about this bug, the more I think that whatever the performance hit is, we're all just going to have to live with it until Intel and ARM and everybody else who is susceptible to this update, like produce new versions of their microarchitecture, produce new chips, essentially. Like there's nothing you can do about the iMac Pro that Marco got now. He's just going to have to run it in the slow mode to be protected from this. I mean, he already is basically because he's got the latest High Sierra. So guess what? You're already doing it, but there's nothing you can do until you wait for Intel to come out with a new chip that is not susceptible to this, because it's not, like I said, it's not a bug or a problem or someone made a boo-boo and they meant it to work one way and it works the other way. This is working as designed. It's just an attack that they didn't account for. And so there's really nothing to do except go back to the drawing board and say, how can we design a CPU that is fast, but that is not susceptible to this category of attack? It's not just one clever thing with one like silly value that trips up something. It's an entire category of attacks that exploit the predictability of what's supposed to be unpredictable. Like one part of one of these exploits, I think, was like that they had completely figured out exactly how the branch predictor works on a particular Intel CPU that helps them predict what it's going to do in various situations, because you do have to manipulate the speculative execution to get it to do what you want. You need to know which things it's going to speculatively execute in which order, so that you can set things up to produce a side effect that gives you actionable information about the thing that wasn't supposed to be read. Right. Anyway, if your eyes are glazing over, we apologize. take a look at all the various PDFs and web pages we will link in the show notes. And then I guess we'll come back next week. And if we're all still alive and the entire world hasn't burned down in a year 2000 style apocalypse, then we can talk about it more.
In the year 2000.
It seems that it's probably going to end up being a really interesting thing to extreme nerds, and most people are probably not going to notice, at least on Macs. On other platforms, I don't know how big the differences are because of their, you know, how they manage memory and stuff, but on Macs, people are saying, who know more about this than we do, that any Mac that has the PCID feature on the Intel chip, which like pretty much all modern chips do from the last 5 or so years, it's not a major performance hit if your Mac is one of these. The problem with us trying to talk about this week, it's so big of a story, probably, that we really can't ignore it. We really can't say, oh, we'll talk about this next week because we don't know enough about it yet. The reality is we're going to talk about it probably both this week and next week because we're going to understand it better next week and more news will have happened, more of the patches will be out, we'll be able to see some of the performance impacts that it has. So this is probably a really big story, but we don't really know yet. Like, it could just be fixed and nobody notices the impact and we all move on. So we apologize. We'll do our best to cover it next week also if there's more news to cover. And I guess we'll just see what happens. But if you are a user who has somehow made it through this explanation and has not skipped the chapter yet, and you don't really understand it and you're worried about it, I would say there's probably not reason to be significantly concerned as an end user from what we know so far.
I would just make, you know, update your operating systems, though.
Yeah, definitely, like, install the updates and everything. But, like, it's not going to all of a sudden make your computer super slow. It's not going to throttle your battery. Or like, it's not going to...
Be the new thing. We should tell people that Microsoft is throttling your Windows computer and Linux is... if only Linux was a company. Tell people it's a company. They'll believe it. The Linux company is throttling your Linux computer by introducing a kernel patch that can produce up to a 30% speed loss. Look at this Select One benchmark in Postgres. Look how much slower it is. Linux is slowing down your computer.
To make you buy a new Linux.
Which is true. They literally are. They're literally patching the kernel to make it slower.
Oh, my God.
And so did Microsoft. And so did Apple. But no one is benchmarking Apple to, you know, no one is running servers on you know, Mac servers and mission critical things. Like the AWS thing, I heard a bunch of people like that. If you had a bunch of systems that were near the edge of their performance envelope on like the EC2 instances that you've provisioned, and they all take like a 2% performance hit, and suddenly you're really close. You go that next few percentage, and now you kind of have a problem and have to get some more hardware. Like this could actually affect, you know, even though it's a small effect, anything you do in sort of cloud computing can have a ripple effect if you're close to the edge of your capacity. So I feel kind of bad that, you know,
then your cloud computing didn't have, if this has a big effect on you, besides the fact that like pretty much every server and cloud instance is probably going to have to be rebooted in the next few days. That's going to be a bigger problem. Like the rebooting all the servers is going to be a more disruptive effect of this than I think anything else. But
well, it could disrupt your monthly bill.
Yeah, but if it disrupts your bill by a meaningful amount, then either this problem is way worse than we thought it was on Linux, or you were already running too close to capacity anyway.
Like that's the thing, is it depends on workload. So if anything's going to have a weird workload that happens to be like super IO intensive or something like that, it's some sort of, you know, like running a database server that is just all it does all day is just tremendous amounts of IO and a 5% hit to your, you know, your $1 million bill. That 5% is a big increase in the amount of hardware you have. Anyway, we'll see how it is. I bet most people will just patch and update everything. But like any one of these problems, you're like, but not everybody's going to patch. And so this is like Heartbleed even. You never know, like, for how long are there going to be systems with, like, the known vulnerable hardware spans many years and probably many vendors, at the very least Intel and ARM. How long is that bum hardware going to be out there? And how much of that hardware will never be updated to run a kernel that is patched to avoid this vulnerability?
We are sponsored this week by Squarespace. Start building your website today at squarespace.com and enter offer code ATP at checkout to get 10% off. Make your next move with Squarespace. Squarespace websites are so incredibly easy to make because these days, No matter what project you're tackling or what new hobby you want to start or what new creative work you want to try to do, chances are you need some kind of website for that, as a home base or promotion or as part of the thing itself, like a podcast. And with Squarespace, you can make websites to do so many different things: blogs, podcasts, portfolios, corporate sites, hobby sites, so many different things, even digital storefronts to sell digital or physical goods. And all of those are incredibly easy to make. You don't have to worry about installing software, configuring things, security updates, version upgrades. There are so many parts of running a website that are kind of a pain if you do it really pretty much any other way. And Squarespace takes care of all that for you. In addition, it's all super easy to actually use. So regardless of your skill level, whether you are a novice to a full-blown web programmer, Squarespace can be for you. It is very, very easy to use. You never have to see or touch any code. Everything is what you see is what you get. And if you want to get super in there and get really involved and actually see the code, you can do that too. And everything in between. It is so easy to make great websites with Squarespace. You will wonder why anybody does it any other way. Try it there first. Whenever you need to do something, just try it there first. See how far you get. I'd say give it like an hour and you'll see, as I have, just how awesome it is to spend a very small amount of time on Squarespace to get a whole site done and then move on and do the thing you actually made the website for. Check it out today at squarespace.com. Start building your website right now with a free trial, no credit card required. Enter offer code ATP at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace, make your next move.
So Aaron Bushnell writes, suppose you had to give up your Mac and solely use iOS, but Apple agreed to add one iOS feature of your choice. What would it be? And let's start with Marco, please.
I had a really hard time with this question because if I were to solely use iOS, I mean, that presumes a lot of things. Like, can I still make iOS apps on iOS? Like, is there a way for me to do that? Because otherwise, my career has a problem. So
iOS has a problem if there's no way to make iOS apps.
Well, that's true. yeah. So, like, I mean, technically, I suppose I should say my answer is the iOS feature that would make me use iOS would be Xcode, but it's so much more complicated than that. Like, you know, so let's assume that somehow the tools to do software development exist as part of this new theoretical world where I'd be forced to use iOS. Other than that, I think I would have to say just larger screen devices because, you know, and you know, like John's wish for like the 27-inch iPad, like, honestly, I don't love that concept for myself for the way I work, but whenever I try to do anything on iOS that is non-trivial, I run into screen size limitations really fast. And I've tried the 12.9-inch iPad briefly. That I didn't find that was for me. Just physically, it felt weird to have like a handheld device of that size for me. So I don't know how this would be in practice, but just some way to get larger screen space. I mean, if only there was a way that the physical size of the input devices that I was interacting with was not tied to the screen size of the device I was using. Maybe we could have like a little proxy touch device that I could touch that was smaller. Maybe like the size, maybe like, you know, the size of like a large iPhone, maybe. I could touch that, maybe put on the desk. And then I could have a nice big screen, like a little bit back, maybe vertical, so I could see it better, where I could arrange a whole bunch of small apps in little rounded rectangles that maybe I could move around and rearrange as necessary. Something like that.
I see what you did there. John?
Marco cheated because this was supposed to be an iOS feature and he started describing hardware, but we'll let it slide. Interest of time. My iOS feature, I think I would probably go with external storage support because it doesn't sound fancy, but it's a really annoying limitation that on an iOS device, you can't just plug something in and then like go to the Files app and just like drag things around in it and like go from Dropbox and drag things, like mounting storage so that it's available to every single application sort of natively everywhere. It's just an unnecessary thing that impedes, you know, like it seems like the bad old world where instead of there being like sort of an equivalent of the Finder or whatever, that everything is application specific. So yeah, the Photos application can read from your SD card or whatever, but an SD card is not universally available and mounted as a volume to any application that wants to look at it, because that's just not the way iOS rolls with the file system. So if I had to use it all the time, I would want it to act in a slightly more Mac-like manner with regards to storage.
For me, I was going to say like a real true to form terminal, which I know you can get from like jailbreaking, and I know you can get, you know, wonderful apps like what is it, Prompt? Is that what I'm thinking of?
Mm-hmm.
That
Panic.
But that doesn't local up and open up a local terminal. That's for connecting to other machines.
Exactly. But I think if I had to choose just one, what I'd actually choose is just being able to sideload apps without going through the App Store and understanding there are risks involved and blah blah blah. But I think I would just want to be able to sideload apps, and I think that would make a tremendous difference.
That's a good one.
And I mean like, you know, being able to download a binary in the same way that you can on a Mac, or, you know, the same way you would get a binary from the App Store, but have it not come from the App Store. So that's what I would say. Brandon Butler asks, and I'm going to slightly tweak the verbiage here. Could all of you give some specific details about why you don't like Windows? I'm genuinely curious. As the potential most recent Windows user, I'll kick this off and say, I haven't used Windows for more than a few minutes in about a year and a half, but the last time I used Windows, which was Windows 10, I believe, the things that bothered me about it the most were, high DPI was not, pervasive throughout the entire operating system. So some things worked at what, you know, we would call retina resolutions in the Mac world, and some would not. They were at the time in the midst of a transition. So there was like, a control panel, but then there were like other places to tweak a lot of the same settings, or sometimes some settings were only in the control panel or only in other places. And it's really, really, really frustrating, especially if you're not deep in the Windows world, to figure out, okay, which one of these two or three places do I need to go to in order to say, change your desktop resolution or something like that. And third of all, the third-party apps, while there is an unbelievable amount of third-party apps for Windows, most of them, in fact, I would almost say the overwhelming majority of them, are utter garbage. And look at something like the last time I used Audacity, it was very, very powerful, but it was visually, I'm not going to say offensive, but hideous. Audacity is available on the Mac as far as I'm aware, but it is like the quintessential GarageBand equivalent for Windows, and it is just hideous to look at. And I just don't think that third-party developers on the Windows platform really take design nearly as seriously as your average third-party developer on the Mac. I believe we started with Marco last time, so John, let's move to you.
So luckily, this question just says some specific details of why I don't like Windows, so I don't have to be exhaustive. You already touched on a bunch of them. I'll throw out some that are near and dear to my heart. The basic interface paradigm of not having a menu bar at the top of the screen, but instead having the menu bar embedded in the window. For someone who likes to have a lot of windows and arrange them, repeating the menu bar in every single one of those windows is incredibly wasteful and infuriating, and it makes it hard to know where the menus are, and, you know, you got the whole infinite height target, yada, yada. Not that I had used the menu bar that much, but just the space savings alone to say, look, we're going to burn the top part of the monitor for the menu bar, but that's it. No matter how many windows you get open, no more space is taken up by the menu bar. The obsession with full screen and the tiling features, which unfortunately the Mac has copied, where, oh, slam the window against the side of the screen, now it's taking up half or the top third or the bottom third. That's not how I use Windows. I don't want that to be that way. I hate full screen. I don't like the, you know, taskbar or whatever the hell they're calling it these days in the bottom that's mutated a lot. I've never liked it. I don't really like the dock that much either, but I like the dock better than that stupid thing. The aesthetics of its sort of DOS origins with backslashes instead of forward slashes and all caps file names that are shouting at me, and, you know, .3 extensions, and many of those limitations, you know, have been slowly winnowed down over the years, but tons of them are still there, including stupid things like drive letters, which just aesthetically just give me the willies, and I do not like. The mouse cursor is the pointer is white instead of black, which is wrong.
Wow.
I mean, just I don't use Windows a lot, but as part of my work, I use it in a virtual machine enough to know that it just doesn't appeal to me in so many ways, like I said, like fundamental ways, like how window management works and how applications work and sort of the connection between like applications and windows and how they appear in the taskbar, to just little tiny picky things of just plain old aesthetics of what icons and menus look like and what font rendering looks like, and you know, and God, drive letters. I mean, just drive letters. That should have been all I had to say.
Marco,
you guys basically covered it. I mean, it's like, you know, death by a thousand cuts. I mean, it's hard to nail down specifics, you know, without having used Windows in a very long time. A lot of it comes down to, you know, what John said about just like design preferences. A lot of it comes down to, Casey, what you said about the quality of most software available and the community around it just being pretty lacking. It's kind of a wasteland of mediocrity and bad decision making. And I if I really had to use something that was not Mac OS, I honestly think I would be more inclined to try to use Linux than Windows at this point. And I used Windows for a very long time. It's not that I didn't know it. I know what I'm missing, basically. And while granted, I haven't used the versions from the last probably literally 10 years or so, from what people say, they aren't that much better in a lot of pretty critical ways, or just kind of in like ecosystem conditions. So I do think I'm speaking from some position of experience, you know, probably not as much as Casey, but more than John. And it just does not fit for me. It really seems incredibly mediocre. And if it's the only thing that I ever knew, and it's the only thing that was available, I could make it work. I would just be annoyed with it pretty frequently, like I was when I was using it full time.
And finally, Mark W. asks, if podcast advertising went away overnight, would you still do the show? I haven't talked to you guys about this, but we used to semi-regularly ask each other, hey, is everyone still cool? Now we just assume it, I guess. But when we started Neutral, when we first recorded, to my recollection, we didn't think we had any sort of advertiser at the time. And then Marco was able to get, was it Squarespace? Is that right?
Yeah, for Neutral, we got Squarespace for the entire run of it. Like, kind of at the last minute, like right before we were going to record and release the episodes, my contact there said, yeah, we'll take them all.
Oh, so it was before we recorded? I thought it was after, but you would remember better
than
me.
It was at least before we released them.
That I agree on. It doesn't really matter in the grand scheme of things. What I was driving at, though, is that one way or another, at least for me, when I started doing this, I was doing it just for fun. I just wanted to talk to my buddies about cars. And it's turned out to be lucrative, which is a tremendous blessing. And I'm super duper thankful for it. But yeah, I think I certainly hope it doesn't go away tomorrow. But if podcast advertising went away tomorrow, I would absolutely still talk to my two good friends for a couple hours about nerdy crap each week. I would suffer through. Marco?
I would do this podcast even if it made a lot less money than it does. And the fact is, if the advertising went away and we had to switch to a direct payment model, I think it probably would make a lot less money than it does. But I would still love to do it. And you know, what's nice is that like having the money coming in from the ads more strongly justifies putting in a lot of time and doing it on a regular schedule. If we didn't have the ad money coming in, it would be a lot easier to say like one week when it's really busy, oh, you know, I can't do it this week. We'll skip this week and we'll just do it next week, or we'll skip the next 2 weeks as some of us are traveling and it's hard to schedule it or something.
Oh, that's a very good point I didn't consider, and I completely agree with you. I mean, I don't remember exactly when it was that we decided this was really a thing, but it was somewhere around the middle of 2013, which is almost 5 years ago. And in almost 5 years, we have not missed a week. And sometimes, particularly in summertime and particularly around Christmas time, we have to do some really ridiculous scheduling in order to get everything to line up such that all three of us will be here every single week. And with one exception, when we deliberately traded John for Christina Warren, we have always had all three of us every week for like 4.5 years. And that is normally very easy, but occasionally extremely difficult. And I agree with you, Marco. We would definitely punt. And I wouldn't say frequently, but a lot more than never if there was no real money involved.
I think you guys covered it. I mean, practically speaking, the show is big enough now that we just do like Patreon or some sort of direct payment, and it would, and you know, we would just continue. Like, and I'm not saying that would be the same as advertising. Like Marco said, it would almost certainly be much, much less, but you know, it would be enough to make it so that we, I think, probably maintain the exact same commitment that we have now.
All right. Thanks to our sponsors this week, Casper, Squarespace, and Flight Logger. And we will see you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin, 'cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him, 'cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYLISS. So that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRACUSA, Syracuse. It's accidental.
So, you are off work, Casey, for a long time, as discussed on the most recent episode of Analog, right?
I'm not. No, I'm not. I worked I worked from home today, but I worked today. So the agreement was, once the baby is born, I'm taking...
Which is any day now.
Which is...
Any second. I mean,
literally, it could be happening...
any day is Mac Pro Day and also baby day.
Yeah, no, seriously.
Like, it is possible that the baby might come out between the time that we record this and when I release it tomorrow.
That's true.
That is possible. Unlikely, but possible. So the agreement with work, which when we recorded Analog, I was going on the assumption that baby would be born before the new year. And there's reasons why I assume that. It's not really worth getting into. But suffice to say, Smart Money said it was already going to be here at this point, and it isn't here. So once the baby is born, I will be off of work for roundabouts of 8 weeks, something like that. So... my company changed from 2017 in 2018 to giving us 3 weeks of paternity leave instead of two. So if the baby was born before the new year, I would have only gotten two weeks of paternity leave. And since the policy has changed and it will be born sometime in 2018, I am getting 3 weeks of paternity leave, which is excellent. And if you're from another country and you think that's barbaric, hey, welcome to America. This is how it works here. Because 3 weeks of paternity leave is unheard of around these parts. Anyway, so after those 3 weeks of paternity leave, I've told work, hey, I'm just going to take some unpaid leave. I'm going to leverage FMLA, which is a law in America that says basically they can't fire you or lay you off when you have to deal with like a big medical issue like a birth. And so I'm going to take some FMLA, and they don't have to pay me, and they won't be paying me, but I'm just going to take a lot of time off. So the thought was that once I was supposed to come back in January, I would just basically blow off January and February. In reality, what's going to happen is I'm going to blow off all of January, probably all of February, and maybe even a little bit of March, depending on when this baby comes. And that's because I want to give Aaron some time to adjust to having two kids. I want to be there, of course, and I want to, you know, adjust to having two kids. And it would just be nice to, you know, have some time with the family. And to bring this back to the Ask ATP that we just finished, really the express reason that I am able to do this, other than just being reasonably financially savvy and not spending, you know, eight times what I make, in no small part, the reason that this is possible is because of every person listening to this show. And to that, I owe all of you, and especially my two co-hosts, you know, my deepest gratitudes, because were it not for the extra money that this show provides my family, I don't think I would be able to do this and take some unpaid leave to be with my new baby and my family. So I'm really excited by it. I have all these visions of all these like outside of work endeavors that I want to work on, like a video of Aaron's car, which I've filmed a teeny bit of, but very, very little of. I want to do an iOS app that's like half cooked, but I have a lot more I want to do for it. And there's all sorts of other things I want to do. But the reality of the situation is your life is destroyed in the best possible way for like 2 months. once a baby, well, at least 2 months, once a baby is born. And so because of that, we'll see if I accomplish getting changed in the mornings or if I'm just stuck in the same PJs for like 2 months, but we'll see. Anyway, why do you bring it up, Marco?
I would like to make you a little bit more uncomfortable right now.
Okay.
So I apologize in advance. You're going to hate this.
No. That's fine.
But you need to hear this.
Mm-hmm.
This is your chance to quit your job. Listen, I'm serious. Okay. What you're going to have is almost 3 months of not going to your job every day, basically not having a job. So you're going to have a nice little preview of what it is like to be independent.
Oh, it's going
to
ruin me.
So, A, yes, it will. B, your job can't fire you for taking this time, but you're certainly going to probably be knocked down the favorites list. I wouldn't assume that you're going to be long for that job anyway. And C, you've been talking for years about wanting how great it would be to work for yourself full time at home, basically, to be there with your family and basically to do the kind of life that I hope that I do, which is like, I'm here when the family needs me. I can be present for moments. I can help out around the house. I can also do some work sometimes and make some money, right? The reason I'm able to do it is because I have good income from a podcast, and I have software development income, making that even better. Well, I know how much you make from your podcast because we split this evenly between the three of us. So you make the same amount that I make and make the same amount that John makes. So I know exactly how much you make from this show because it's the same that I do. And so I know that's pretty good. And I know, of course, it's, you know, irregular with, you know, when the hell advertisers pay and everything. And we get like bursts of money here and there and then nothing for months and then big bursts of money. So like it isn't like a normal income. It doesn't provide health insurance and stuff like that. So, you know, I augment this with software development. That's basically what you do, too. You just that your software development is from a job that it, like you're working for somebody else. They're paying you. They're handling a bunch of crap for you. It's pretty consistent, etc. So this is a chance for you to try not to do YouTube full time because that has a very, very slow ramp up.
Sure.
You're not going to get to a YouTube career in 2 months. That's not going to happen. This gives you a chance to become an iOS consultant as the other part of your income. So you too will have software development income as well as podcast income. That is enough to have a pretty nice life. And so I'm telling you right now, I think you should go into this break seriously with the expectation that you might not go back. And now I'm telling the listeners, because I know the kind of listeners that we have, make Casey do this. I'm serious. Make Casey do this because by sending him work, if you have consulting work, Casey did not ask me to say this, and he's probably really mortified right now that I'm saying this. If you have consulting work that Casey could do for your company, hire him now so that he can get this going, and then in 2 months, he won't have to go back to his job. This is your time to do this. This is an opportunity. Because look, some people are naturals at going into independent life. Some people, you know, they jump right in, or they make a big plan and execute that plan, and they're able to do it right. That's not what I did. I was pushed into it. I was quit fired. Like I had been kind of wanting to maybe do it, like you say sometimes, but I didn't choose when that happened. I was pushed into the deep end, and I was so incredibly thankful for that. It was like the best thing that could have happened to me. It was an external force forcing me to do something that I should have done because I needed that push. You have that push now, sort of, in a way, because a baby's coming into your life again. You know how much work that is. So you're taking this nice sabbatical from work to have paternity leave to, you know, get things going. This is your push. Make it happen. this, and I'm telling you, audience, please, for the love of God, hire Casey. Make him do this. We will all be so thankful, including Casey, if he can, because look, you will be so much happier.
You know someone who might not be thankful and might not be happy?
No, it's, no, there isn't.
Is it? No, there is this one person that I think might not be so happy about this and might not be so thankful. And that's Aaron, who expects Casey to be on paternity leave because he's going to help with the new baby and Declan. Where if instead he's on paternity leave working on himself, starting his consulting business while she juggles two screaming children, I'm thinking maybe she's not going to be so thankful for this advice. Like, this is the flaw in this plan. Like, I'm with Marco right up to the point where, oh, and by the way, Casey has a new baby. Like, the whole point of this vacation is not let's launch Casey's independent career. Like, he's taking this time off for a reason. And everything you're describing takes time away from the reason he's supposedly taking off for. And so I feel like this is maybe not the right time. And secondarily, having a screaming baby at home is going to make Casey long for the office on some days. It's going to be like, I wish I could leave this house and go to a place with adults and just do work in quiet peace. Like, everyone has those moments with babies. It's just a fact of life. And so, unfortunately, when he's at the end of this time, he may find himself begging to go back to the office, which is exactly the opposite of what you want to get him, like, booted out into the independent lifestyle. So I'm thinking maybe the timing isn't exactly right. Obviously, when is the time right? If you really wanted to make this happen, Marco, you need to get him fired from his job. After
thanks,
back.
John.
But I think in that case, Casey and Aaron both wouldn't be very thankful to you. So I don't know what the solution is here.
No, you know, I appreciate it. First of all, let me say I appreciate it. It's funny because I really don't have any particular interest in going back to consulting. And let me provide a verbal glossary for a minute. When I say consulting, I mean both flavors of consulting, because there's the consulting that I did in years past, which is I was part of a company and a group of us would be given, well, poor choice of words, but given to another company to do work for that other company, and then that work would cease and I would go back to my original company. So I'm always an employee of my original company, but I bring this up to say I didn't have to pay for healthcare. Well, I did, but you know what I mean? Like, there was company healthcare. I didn't have to drum up work because there was a sales team that did that for me. So I basically just showed up, billed my hours, and left. And so it was still consulting in the sense that I had little to no control over my destiny, but it was not consulting in the same way that you're talking about, Marco, because the work just fell in my lap. And if it didn't, that wasn't really my problem. This is different, what you're discussing, because it would be forevermore my responsibility to figure out how to put money in my pocket and thus how to get work on my desk. And that scares the ever-living crap out of me. You're right to say that the only way I would leave my job is if I had a considerable amount of work lined up in advance. So, you know, over these 2 months. Oh, I know. But hear me out for a second. Okay. So the thought is if I really want to go down this road, I think John's right that I don't think I can really do this. I don't think I could actively start, you know, the Caseyless Consulting Corp. The Casey Consulting Corp, very alliterative. Anyway, I couldn't start Casey Consulting Corp while I was off, because John's absolutely right. Like, the point of this break is to be with the family, and I don't really want to taint that with work. But if I knew that at the end of this break, so, you know, early to mid-March, I had maybe a month or two of solid work lined up, I would certainly consider not going back to my jobby job. But that's a really hard thing to do. And you're absolutely right, Marco, to say, it's not quite so easy. But it would take a lot for me to take this stable, well, what I perceive as a stable paycheck. And yes, we can get into the argument that no paycheck is stable, blah, blah, blah. But to say no to the stable paycheck and healthcare, and instead say, you know what, I'll just figure it out. I'm not a I'll just figure it out kind of guy in a lot of ways.
Neither was I.
Oh, I know. And all of that said, what I haven't mentioned yet is that I've been talking to a lot of our mutual friends and feeling out, hey, I know you probably don't have enough work for a full-time partner, but do you have a little bit of work you could send my way? And I hadn't had a chance to ask you this question, Marco, but you are on the list of people I wanted to talk to about this, you know, because
Marco doesn't
vision,
work well with others. Sorry.
I know he doesn't, but yet here we are 4.5 years later. So there is something to be said for Marco's
not
ability.
Programming work. Marco even fired his support people. He can't even have someone do support.
I know.
It's better to just not do support than to have hire someone do support. He works alone like Batman. Sorry.
Can I not be your
no
Robin, Marco?
Robin.
Can I not be your Robin? No, but seriously, though, I've been polling a lot of our mutual friends to say, hey, you know, my thought has basically been, well, if Marco can give me 5 hours a week fairly reliably, like, and I'm not asking you to say yes or no right now. I'm just saying, hypothetically, Marco says,
what would that cost?
Well,
honestly, I'm asking, but I don't even know. I have no concept of what consultants cost. What?
Well, and the thing is, I don't really either, which means I haven't really done my homework.
Would this
but
be like $1,000? Is that? I have no idea.
I think what it would basically amount to is
more than that.
Yeah. Okay.
So
we're talking like $5,000 a month at least, or like,
so an hourly, a reasonable hourly rate is anywhere between $100 and like $300, depending on geography, skill level, etc. So call it, let's split the difference and call it $150 an hour times, say, 5 hours a week times 4 weeks a month. That's like $3,000 a month, right? So, and again, I'm not asking you to say anything right now. I'm just trying to pose a hypothetical here. So if you say to me, you know what, Casey, I'm good for $3,000 a month for at least a couple of months, maybe even 6 months.
I would do that if you quit your job.
well, that's what I'm saying.
I'd find something for you to do, whether it's like, you know, working on stuff on the app that I can't get to, or doing the web app, or you can make yourself a Mac app. I don't care. I'd do that.
Well, and I appreciate that. Genuinely, that's very kind of you.
I'm serious.
But, you know,
if you become a full time consultant.
I know. Oh, I know. There's caveats here. But
it's,
you know,
like
my
Kickstarter. You gotta like
complete, yeah, exactly.
You gotta do the whole thing.
So yeah, that's kind of what it is, though, right? So you dedicate, you know, 5 hours a month for 6 months, and underscore dedicates another 5 hours a month for 6 months, or 5 hours a week. I'm sorry, 5 hours a week for, you know, 6 months, and underscore says, yeah, you know, I think I could get 5 hours of work your way for 6 months. Suddenly, you know, I'm at 10 hours, and if I do that 4 more times over, that's a full work day. Well, but to an American anyway, 40 hours a week is a full work week. Now, maybe the answer is I just understand that I'm taking a pay cut, and maybe I only work 30 hours a week and I just am okay with that. You know what I mean? So like, I haven't really taken this too seriously yet, but I will say that I've talked to a few of our mutual friends, or a couple of our mutual friends, and started to float this idea of, hey, if you have things that you can't get to or don't want to be bothered by, and you're willing to throw money at that problem, hey, think of me. You know, I could maybe make that work. And I don't know if that's going to work out, but that's like my fantasy world, where I have all of the perks of being my own man and, you know, leaving the jobby job and doing my own thing, but at least in the beginning, very little of the drama about it, hypothetically, in that I've already established that between you and underscore and Bob and Susie and Timmy and Sally, I know that I'm going to get, you know, 40 hours of or 30 hours or whatever of work out of you for at least a few months to at least get me going. And then at that point, in theory, it should hopefully start taking care of itself. And I can either, you know, talk to local businesses if I need to, or maybe it turns out that you and I work super well together and in this capacity. And maybe you say, you know what, let's go have half and half on overcast. Obviously I'm talking out my butt here, but you know what I mean? Like, maybe that'll start to figure itself out after that. And that's like my fantasy land, but we'll see what actually ends up happening. But the tough thing about it is just what John said. Like, I think I can do some of this. I can do some of the hustling during this 2 months, but I don't think I can do the actual working during this 2 months, you know?
Even your optimistic projections make me think that your consulting work will pay for the healthcare you're giving up by losing and leaving your job, based on how much Marco is paying for healthcare as an independent, you know, like, I don't, maybe it's cheaper where you are than it is in New York.
Well, I'm sure it is.
But healthcare costs a lot. So yeah, because that's the main thing I feel like you're giving
up.
Well,
it's just a number, though. that's the thing. Like, so many people, myself included, were scared to go independent because of health insurance. And that's a big reason, but it's just a number. So it isn't that you can't buy it. It isn't that you can't have health insurance. It's that you have to figure out a way to make that much money. That's it. Like, remove the emotional drain of it as being like this big thing in your life, and just consider it like, if I'm going to be independent, I have to at least make this amount more than I think I do to pay for the health insurance. And that's all it is. It's just a number.
Yeah, but it's a big number. That's the point.
It's like over $1,000 a month for almost any situation with a family. But like, that's just a number. So you have to you're paying that now, sort of like with work taxes and what they pay you versus what they're charging. Like, someone's paying it now. Like, it isn't that your healthcare now is free. You know, it's being paid for somehow. But anyway, this is an incredible opportunity that you have here. You basically have the ability, you have the opportunity to dip your toe in the water of this market to see if this is the kind of thing that you can and want to do. Now, granted, as John said, like, you're also going to be taking care of a family with a newborn in it. So that's you're going to be busy and tired, but this is an opportunity that is unique in your life right now. Like, you're not going to get a better chance to try this out than this for a long time. Like, this is a really good chance. And also, knowing nothing about, you know, the people at your company or the politics of your job, because we don't talk about that, I really don't think that this job is going to be as long-lasting or stable as you might want after you take this break. I don't know any company that would look favorably upon this. Like, even if they say it beforehand, they might think that. Some of them might, you know, somebody who matters might think that or might be saying that. But the reality is, you're going to be kicked down to the bottom of a totem pole after this. And if push comes to shove, if they want to, like, change things up in the department, or they get new leadership or something, like, I would not assume this job would still be there. So at some point, you're going to be thrust into this, probably, of like, oh, what do I do now? Right now, you can do that without taking any risks, because you're already, like, you've already booked yourself for this, you know, paternity leave and this, like, sabbatical kind of thing, whatever you're calling it, like, with the company.
Sure.
You're already doing this. You have this chance now laid out for you. I highly suggest you take advantage of it. And I'm asking the audience, just bury Casey with offers for consulting work, just to show him how possible this is. Like, this is totally a thing that people do that can happen. If only, you know, most people are like, geez, I would love to get more consulting work, but I don't have any way to reach people. Turns out you have some ways to reach people. And even though you won't use them this way, I will. So for the love of God, bury Casey with work. Give him consulting offers from your company's people. Give him your money. that's what Casey needs. Because you need that push. I know, because I needed that push. And I can tell, you know, I was, many of the things you're saying about the way you look at these things is the way I was looking at things. You need this push. This is a great opportunity to have that. For the love of God, audience, make him take this opportunity.
I appreciate it. And yeah, we'll see what happens. I don't know. I would love for it to be the case, and yeah, we'll see what happens when this episode is released. But I don't know. It's a scary thought. It's a super scary thought. I am super fiscally conservative within the family's financial world. I am super scared of risk, and I always pronounce the word wrong. I always want to say adverse, and that's not right, is it? Anyway,
averse.
Thank you. I really don't like taking risks, and the worrywart in me, the Chicken Little within me, says, "Are you insane? I'm adding another mouth to feed, another person to be responsible for that I am wholly responsible for because I am lucky enough that Aaron doesn't have to work." And yeah, now I'm going to take this reliable paycheck again, understanding that not all paychecks are really and truly, well, really no paycheck is truly reliable, but just go with me here. I'm going to take this reliable paycheck and say, yeah, no, thank you. Like, that's bananas. Why would I do that? But on the other side of the coin, I totally understand where you're coming from. And yeah, you know, if it ends up that I think I can scrounge up, you know, 30 to 40 hours of work for at least a few months at least passable rates, it would be hard to say no to that, because having the flexibility to be with the family would be pretty darn nice. So
yeah,
we'll see.
I'll tell you why you'll do it. Because you are the kind of person who highly values that presence and time with your family. That's why you've been talking about it for years.
Yeah.
Because you do want to be there. And, by the way, another reason to possibly give this up, you could make more.
Oh, yeah. Oh, certainly.
Have you considered that? Like, it's not like you're taking a huge pay cut forever. You're taking probably a small pay cut for a little while. And then after that, you could make more than you were making before, all while being home much more often. And this is even setting aside, like, yeah, you're going to have to, like, have some times where you can't help out the family because you're busy working. That's going to happen, of course. That's a thing. But you're still going to have way more time at home than you do now. And you'll have also way more flexibility. And that is so, so nice when I go to all of my kids' doctor's appointments because I can. Little things like that. That stuff just, it adds up, and it ends up you can have so much more presence in your family's life if you can be working at home for yourself and kind of dictate how you spend your own time. Like, it's a pretty big change and upgrade of lifestyle. And the only reason a lot of people don't do it is because a lot of people can't do it. And I totally understand that. But you, I think, have a chance here and an opportunity here that a lot of people would kill for. And that's why I think you should take it. And rather than viewing it as like a huge risk to taking like a big pay cut and giving up this income and stability you have, I would instead view it as an opportunity to make even more money with way more freedom and way more presence to your family to establish what would probably end up being the most stable and bulletproof type of income you could have. Because you would have diverse sources that are all within your control. And there's like overall market forces that might affect it, but that's way less likely to be a problem for you than like one particular job that you happen to work for, you know, things going bad there or changing there or that company having problems or whatever else. So for the love of God, people, hire Casey right like now. Like, I want people to flood you with offers in the next like 2 weeks, because obviously like probably in the next week you're having a baby. So like that's, you know, the next week is going to be busy for you. But like,
you don't say.
The week after that, start looking at offers and start doing the math, because babies, I know they're a lot of work, but they do sometimes sleep. Not for very long necessarily, but you will have time where you will be able to like browse your phone while you're like heating up a bottle or something. Like, you will
time. That's when Declan's going to stop napping.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, like, there will be opportunities for you to check your email and to read your phone and to run some numbers in Solver. Like, this exists. This is it. Like, take this opportunity to really give this a try. Because the worst thing that happens is you decide either you hate this and you want to go and you want to rush back to work. Like, there's a reason I don't tell John to do this, because I know John would hate this kind of thing. So I don't tell John to do this. John loves his day job. Or at least...
Do I?
John loves having a day job.
That's the correct phrasing for that statement.
That's also not true.
Yes, it is, John. Come on. You're a company person.
I'm with Marco on this. Like, if you have to work at all, I think you love having a regular, standard, stable day job in many of the same ways I do. I'm not trying to paint you as like a loner on this.
You don't know my life.
Oh, God. We know come your on.
Life. I don't want to work more than anybody, more than all of you combined. Because Marco's a workaholic and literally doesn't know how to not work. And Casey, I think, is just middle of the road normal, but I desperately don't want to work.
that's probably true. But the point is, like, I think of the three of us, like, I would never recommend John go independent, because I know
I would never do consulting, I can tell you that. If you want to say nail something I hate, consulting is like my idea of a nightmare.
Right. Like, I know you would hate this, and so I would never recommend this to you. But I know, Casey, you could do it, and I think you would appreciate, like, I think whatever, you know, because consulting isn't like all you know, roses, but like,
oh no, it's not. In a lot of ways, I hate it. But you're about to say, I think, what is absolutely true, that in this fantasy world where I have enough work laid out in front of me that I can perhaps even be mildly choosy about it, and in this fantasy world where I'm able to work from home and actually get work done and be there for the family at hours wherein I need to be there, like all of that would make the juice worth the squeeze, where even though I really hate the idea of being a full-time consultant again, it, all those perks would make it worth it if I could be there for the family, if I could make my own hours and choose my own clients, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly. Like, I really think you could do this. I really think this is a great chance to do it. And I think the audience would come through if you need them to. And you do. I really think they could make this happen. Because look, you have, like, look at the opportunity you have. You have like 2 or 3 months of free, you know, free in the sense of like they're not going to fire you, free leave from work, during which you could set this up if you wanted to. You have a platform where we can beg people to hire you, and 100,000 people are going to hear this. And you don't need 100,000 people to hire you. You need like 10.
No, but if all 100,000 would like to send me an offer,
like surely at least 10 people in the audience can send you a serious offer.
Oh my word, that's hilarious. Yeah, I mean, we'll see what comes out of this, but it is very kind of you to make the impassioned plea, and I very, very deeply appreciate it. And
well, one of us has to.
Well, and for the listeners too, if you've stuck around for this part, I also again I appreciate you guys affording my family the ability for me to take that time off, even if I squander it and just go crawling back to work. It just, the fact that I can take that time is an extreme blessing, and I'm really thankful for it. It's funny with my job, you know, I think I'm more valuable than you're painting me, but I think that's more about circumstance than it is necessarily about, oh, I'm so fancy. As it turns out, you know, the particular employer that I work at, we have two teams, one on the West Coast, one on the East Coast. And on the East Coast, the iOS team, as it stands right now, is myself and an intern. And so it is not in my work's best interest to get rid of me unless they're getting rid of the entire East Coast operations for iOS, which is certainly possible. And for a long time, I thought we were on the precipice of doing exactly that. Now, I don't think that's the case. Here again, I acknowledge you'll never really know. It could happen tomorrow, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I am fully aware of that. But I think I am at least mildly valuable by circumstance, if not by ability. And I think I am relatively valuable based on ability. Certainly not a lot of people really understand RX Swift and whether or not you like it, whether or not you think it's a good idea. It is a unique skill. So if anyone is interested in, if anyone happens to want an RX Swift consultant, let me know. But I think I have more flexibility in this job than I have in most jobs to be at doctor's appointments and be at home when necessary. And I think that I am more valuable at this job, again, either by circumstance or ability or both, than I am at a lot of places. However, I still, by and large, agree with your points that, you know, there's no amount of flexibility that is more than working for yourself. And, you know, I did the semi-hard work in 2017 of setting up an LLC for myself. So some of that administrivia is already taken care of. And in some ways, I'm even better equipped than, you know, to run with this, which is kind of neat. So,
yeah, like you're already dealing with, like, you know, having to do estimated taxes and everything from the income from this show. Like you're already dealing with that from side income from your podcasting. So like that's, and let me offer an alternative perspective on your current status. You and I have talked before about the whole, you know, company having West Coast and East Coast things. And I didn't know whether you wanted to bring that up on the show, but since you did bring that up, let me give you an alternate perspective on what you just described as your status there. Your company seemingly used to have a lot more iOS people on the East Coast.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now they're on the West Coast and the East Coast has just you left and you're about to take off 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
I would look at this as a really good opportunity for the company to consolidate their operations location. Like,
and I
think they're going to look at that. Like, and also you're saying you're super awesome and valuable to the company, but you're about to take 3 months off, and they're going to have to figure out how to do things without you, and so they will. Like,
oh, totally.
I'm not saying that you're going to walk in March and be immediately laid off, but like, I think this is, you know, if they're looking to consolidate on the West Coast, which certainly looks possible, I think, yeah, this wouldn't make my list of incredibly reliable paychecks.
No, and I agree. Now, for what it's worth, what I haven't mentioned is we actually have a new iOS developer starting next week, I believe, or week after. And that person is fairly junior. So the understanding was is that they were just going to kind of do their thing until I get back, and then I'll tutor them on the ways that we do things at my employer. But I'm not saying you're wrong by any stretch. I'm just saying it's not the sort of thing where I've turned the eight ball over and it says all signs point to you getting laid off. I'd say some of the signs point to me getting laid off, but not all of them. But who knows? I don't know. In a perfect world, you know, I will either get a bazillion wonderful job offers and I'll have to choose who I would like my clients to be, or there will be nothing but crickets and that will solve the problem a different way. But we'll see what happens. I appreciate you giving me the nudge, and that's very kind of you.
Oh, I'm dead serious. This is not a nudge. This is a push. Audience, you know what to do.